Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with the winners of the 2017 Diana Pinkley Prizes for Crime Fiction. Louise Penny, the Canadian novelist whose new Armand Gamache mystery is Glass Houses, is the recipient of the prize for a distinguished body of work. Trudine Ann Boyce of Atlanta, winner of the debut novel prize for Out of the Blues, will also be with us. Canadian novelist Louise Penny is one of the most beloved writers in the world, with millions of copies of her books in print in 23 languages. Her 13th, Glass Houses, featuring Chief Inspector Armand Gamache, is just out. Many readers have traveled the road to her fictional village of Three Pines and longed to stay there for good, even though it seems at times that it's the murder capital of Quebec. And we will be lucky enough to welcome her for her first visit to New Orleans September 8th, when she will receive the Diana Pinkley Prize for Crime Fiction, honoring Louise's distinguished body of work. Louise Penny, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here, Susan. Thank you.
Well, I was struck, as so many readers will be, by the opening image of Glass Houses when a dark-robed, masked, silent figure disrupts the joy of a Halloween party and then returns to stand in the village green the next day. I hope you'll tell us how the image of the Cobrador del Frac came to you.
It is something that I heard about, I would say 15 years ago, before I started writing even. One of my husband's great friends, who he met at college, went to work for the Financial Times in Madrid. And then 15 years ago, he came, he visited us in Canada, and over drinks one night, he was talking about this phenomenon in Spain. And it is about a figure that wears a top hat and tails, very formal, and carries a briefcase, and follows people. And we asked him, we said, Richard, why would he follow? What's the point of it? He said he follows this person from their home to their work to having lunch back home, never talks to them, never approaches, if approached, never responds, just follows. And Richard said this person is a debt collector, and he shames the person into paying. And apparently it works. So I tucked that away, and then when I started writing crime fiction, I remembered it, but I thought I need to wait until the characters, until the books have reached a certain stage where it makes sense, until I've reached a certain stage as a writer where I can make full use of this. And in this case, the Cobrador, as they're called, that shows up, Gamache realizes, after doing research, what it is, but also realizes that this is not a normal debt collector, that the debt it is there to collect isn't monetary, it is a moral debt. And then things devolve from there.
Well, I love the way this image of the debt collector affects everyone. I mean, they all think he's there for them.
When I cross borders, and the border guard perfectly civilly asks me questions, I start blushing like I'm guilty. Do you have that?
Yes, I do. We all have some secret, and we all wonder if such a figure might appear in our front yard someday, you know? But from the very first book of yours, Still Life, you've talked about revealing secrets and about the power of conscience and cowardice.
Yes, thank you for asking that. That is actually a line from Oscar Wilde, who said that, and he was a great roué, of course, in his opinion, conscience and cowardice are the same thing, that the only thing that drives us to do what is right is a fear of getting caught. And that if we knew, or absolutely guaranteed, we would not be caught doing something, what would we do? Would we steal? Would we lie? Would we have an affair? Would we murder?
Ooh, there's a terrible question.
Well, it's one that what I like exploring in the books, because the books are obviously and proudly crime fiction, but I suspect the least interesting part of the book is the crime itself. It's really about all these other issues of what makes us as humans do what we do. The crime isn't the pulling of the trigger, although that's the final act. It is what drives that. What has forced someone into such a horrific and final act? It forces me, as I'm writing, to look at these issues. There's no easy answer for me. I don't know. I know what the right answer is, but the truth is, I don't know. I don't know what I would do if I knew I wouldn't get caught. It's uncomfortable.
It is. It is a very uncomfortable thing to think about. Now, one of the great keys to the success of these books, I think, is that great contrast between the domestic pleasures, getting to know the characters, imagining you're at Myrna's bookstore, Olivier and Gabri's bistro, and the difficulties of the larger world. And in this case, it's the ever-increasing world of drug trafficking. And it's as if the troubles of the world grow ever closer, invading even a small town like Three Pines.
That's a very good point. It's intentionally idyllic. I wanted to create a village that would feel safe, that would look safe, but what psychologists call the third place, which our first place is home, our second place is work, and the third place is the safe place, often of our memory or our imagination, that we go to when the world isn't what we hoped it was. And Three Pines is kind of that, the third place. But again, what happens when the world encroaches? Because there's something slightly mythological about it. It's only ever found by people lost. It's not on a map. But within my fictional world, it actually exists. People who live there exist. It's not like the island in Lost. So what happens when things like drugs, when murder, when abuse violate people's safe place? And again, what will people do? And it's interesting that you talk about contrast, because I often think that the books are about many things, but one of them is duality. The contrast between this intentionally very pretty and idyllic village, peaceful village, and the crimes that violate it. The world that is encroaching, the shadows that are being thrown into the sunshine. But also the duality, the gap between the pretty homes and what is happening behind the closed doors. Between what we say and what the characters say out loud and what they're actually thinking. Personally, I find that quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. I love it, especially when a character who's never let people into their home suddenly is exposed. Yeah. You know, you see, oh, so that's what they've been hiding all this time.
Secrets.
Yes, or bad decorating. I mean,
and decorating.
Now, Inspector Gamache has held our hearts for so long. He's a man who loves his quotidian pleasures, but he also has grand ambitions and moral responsibilities that he feels so very keenly. And his ambition in Glass Houses is positively quixotic. I mean, you have this deep feeling that if anyone can make this happen, he will. And he is willing to bet everything in the service of good.
Yes. There is a quote that's used from Gandhi about exactly that, about the court of the conscience, and that it supersedes all else. And Gamache, in this book, and you're absolutely right, through the book, through the series, the conscience is a kind of leitmotif. It sort of comes in and out like a river through the books. I mean, how can you have a crime series that doesn't talk about the conscience? But it's more evident in this book. And Gamache is very much challenged by his choices. I talk about Cortez in the book, the Spanish explorer, and his choices, and Churchill and his choices with Coventry. And Gamache is facing his own Coventry, and that's how far are you willing to go on the short term to protect society on the long term? And it's questions facing us all today.
Exactly. And it's his biggest undertaking in so many ways.
And risking not simply his career or the careers of those who are close to him, but so much more. And, you know, there is a final price to be paid.
Mm-hmm. And you've often said that when you were making up Armand Gamache, you were conjuring your ideal man, and then you looked across the table, and there he was, and you were already married to him.
Aren't I clever?
Yes.
No, I have no imagination at all. I write essentially the community I live in and the food I eat, and now I have written the main character is actually my husband. Yes, he had all the qualities. Michael and Armand share so many qualities of integrity, of humor, of taking their work very, very seriously, but not necessarily themselves all that seriously, of having a great capacity for friendship and for love and gratitude. I don't think you get gray in your hair without reaching that fork in the road where so much has happened and life has battered you so much that you either become embittered or you become compassionate. Mm-hmm. And Michael became compassionate. And he guided me toward that when life, I felt, was unfair. And he made it clear that, you know, it's not unfair. You have been born with every advantage, and so don't think that you should lead a magical life when people lead worse lives. And so they share that with Gamache.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so interesting that, you know, for readers, books are such consolation. And people feel that way about Three Pines, that it is an escape and a comfort, even though it is a murder scene most often. But still, it seems that for you, the writing, the creation of this place has offered you that consolation in this time.
It is ironic, isn't it, that I wrote it hoping that others might find a haven. And then 12 years, 10 years later, I find the same haven in writing the books. That people find it in reading, and I find it in writing. And I needed that. And it genuinely became a harbor as Michael's disease progressed. And I was able every morning, as I wrote Glass Houses, I would look after him first thing and get up early and then go into the living room with the dog and my cup of coffee and write. And I was able to go into Three Pines with my community of friends and a lovely village I would choose to live in, and Armand, who is immortal now, and a world that I could control, and a world where goodness exists. That's a line that I'm not sure I've ever actually used in the books, but it's a poem from Auden in his Elegy to Melville that permeates the series and, in fact, informs the entire series, that goodness exists. His terror had to blow itself quite out to let him see it. But at the end of the day, it's about goodness, and I know that goodness exists.
We've been talking with best-selling author Louise Penny, whose wonderful new novel is Glass Houses. You can meet her Friday, September 8th at 6 at the Academy of Sacred Hearts, NIMS Fine Arts Center at 4301 St. Charles, when she'll be receiving the Diana Pinkley Prize for Distinguished Body of Work in Crime Fiction. Tickets available at Octavia Books or octaviabooks.com. Louise, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Susan. I can hardly wait to get to New Orleans.
It is such a pleasure to talk with Trudy Nan Boyce, the winner of this year's Diana Pinkley Prize for Crime Fiction. That's in the debut novel category for her book, Out of the Blues. Trudy has one of the best resumes for a writer of crime fiction you could imagine. She got a PhD in community counseling, then went to work for the Atlanta Police Department. Her 30 years there included stints as a homicide investigator, in the Special Victims Unit, as a commander, and hostage negotiator. After she retired, she turned to writing. Her second novel, Old Bones, was published earlier this year. Trudy Nan Boyce, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
I'm very pleased to be with you, Susan. I'm so looking forward to coming to New Orleans.
Well, you racked up some years on the street before you turned to writing. And I'm curious to know if writing was always a goal for you, if it was always something you aspired to do.
I had not given thought to writing. I was always a huge fan of reading. When I was a freshman in college, I turned in a paper and got some really discouraging news. So I kind of gave up the idea about being a writer. But in 2001, I was working crimes against children. And as part of my responsibilities, I was the sergeant in crimes against children. And as a part of my responsibilities every day, I would go and get the reports from the field, the reports from the uniformed officers and also from Child and Family Services. And these were reports about alleged child sexual abuse, physical abuse, neglect, and runaways. And every morning I would gather up these reports, and I would have 30 or 40 reports about children who had been mistreated. Mm-hmm. That would be hard on anybody to do that every morning, and then I would assign them to my detectives. That year also, my best friend of more than 30 years, and we were the kind of friends who talk on the phone every other day. We had been roommates from time to time and seen each other through marriages and divorces and children, and she died that year of breast cancer. And the combination of stress at work and losing my friend put an additional strain on a marriage that already was under pressure, and my marriage crumbled that year. So I needed a place to go and have a catharsis, and I went to our local fine arts center, and they had a class on fiction writing. And like every other class, you start out with exercises, and I got a lot of encouragement from the wonderful instructor that we had at the Callan-Wall Fine Arts Center. And when I turned in my first piece, she said, "Well, I hope this is a draft of your first novel." And I hadn't even thought about that. I was just doing the exercise. So I got a lot of encouragement, and I've been writing since 2001.
Sometimes that's all it takes. Now, the character of the detective is always what draws readers and keeps them, and Sarah Ault, called Salt, is just a complicated and interesting woman. So tell us about creating her and what you took of yourself, what you gave her that maybe you had always wanted. She's so interesting.
Well, I wanted a character that would reflect what it feels like to be a beat cop as she started out, and you'll see that in the prequel that's coming out next February, and what the pressures of the street do in combination with somebody who is already a fully formed human being. And none of us are blank slates, so we all come to our jobs and our relationships with a history. And Salt has a history, and so I was interested in how that would play out. And she is from a police family and has had a tragic background, not unlike some people who are on the police department now and who work as police officers. People see the uniform, and it's hard sometimes to see the human being behind that. And so I was interested in looking at that in combination with how that feels to come in contact with all this trauma that you see in communities of poverty.
Now, one of the things I love about Salt is that she has a rich spiritual life, and that seems to balance the rough and tumble of her professional life.
Well, that is also something that was not planned on my part. I worked from character-driven inspiration, and my novels are character-driven rather than plot-driven, so what happens is that the story unfolds for me in the process of writing. And I had not planned to have a spiritual component. However, I do come from a family. My dad was a preacher. And you can hardly live in the South without religion being in some way, shape, or form.
Oh, no kidding.
Affected by that. Right. So that's just started showing up. And I call myself a secular Presbyterian. And so you can take the girl out of the church, but you can't take the church out of the girl. So it shows up.
And she's so strong. And she's constructing this interesting family of a chosen family, which is always so interesting.
We do that, don't we?
Yeah.
Especially if we want to be nourished and nurture a family, then the people that are next to us and with whom we come in contact on a daily basis often end up becoming our family. We live in a wonderful old neighborhood here in Atlanta, and I've lived here since 85, I guess. And a huge part of my family is the construct family that involves our neighbors and friends right next door to us.
Oh, sure. Now, I always love crime fiction with a strong setting, and you have Atlanta down pat. That city provides so much inspiration for you on so many different levels.
Well, I thought I knew the city, and I have lived in or around the city since 1962. I've relived right downtown since 76, and I've lived in some really colorful parts of town just in terms of the characters that are on the street. So I thought I knew the city, especially I got my degrees at the downtown university. I lived in an old neighborhood, Grant Park, which is right downtown. And, of course, I policed in the city for more than 30 years, so I thought I knew the city. But when I started doing the research for the writing, that took me in directions that I never dreamt possible. And I continue to uncover the tragedy and the magic of the city, and I think that will be a never-ending thing to try to find and to understand the city. James Baldwin, I read a quote from him that I really loved, and he compared writing to a journey. He said, "A journey is called that because you never know what you're going to find, and you never know what you'll do with what you find." And mm-hmm. Here's my favorite part. And he says, "And you never know what you find will do to you."
Ah, yes.
And that has absolutely been true for me, is because I think that writing has become a way for me to understand a lot of what I encountered on the street, mm-hmm. a way for me to understand the city in all of its complicated history.
So what was it like for you to make that change, to go from, you know, having this complex social interaction every day and sitting in a room at a desk, you know, and turning your attention to the page? Was that a hard transition for you, or was it a welcome one?
It was certainly welcome, because what started to happen with me is I started to really understand both my role in the interactions that I had with people on the street, to understand that better. I always think of myself as an empathetic person, but there was certainly a lot that I did not understand about the culture of poverty. And even though I continue to think of that most of my interactions were helpful to people, I don't think I fully appreciated how complicated that things can be for people on the street.
Mm-hmm.
There's a cliche about walking in someone's shoes. I have a character in my novels called Little D.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of represents that ubiquitous kid on the street that you see hanging out on the corner in the white T-shirt and the baggy pants, who's old enough to be out working, and you see him hanging around. And we all do this. We pass by and think, why don't they go get a job? If they just spend that energy that they have hanging out on the street and dealing drugs, they could really go somewhere in the world. And I had to step inside of that kid's shoes, Little D. He started kind of as a walk-on character.
Mm-hmm.
And then he became much more fleshed out as I wrote. And I came to understand him so much better than I did when I was policing.
Oh, and I can't wait to see what happens to him next. Now, when you're doing police work, you know in the most concrete way that you're making a difference. And I wonder if writing gives you that same satisfaction. So many crime writers now know that they're in the business of social commentary, really.
Absolutely. And I hope that readers will come away with both a fuller understanding of law enforcement people and also of people who are struggling and who are on the other side, oftentimes, of the law. In my favorite TV show of all time was The Wire, and the thing that I loved about that show is that the cops weren't all good and that the perpetrators weren't all bad. We were much more complicated than that. So I'm very hopeful that that's what readers will come away with, a better understanding of what it means to live in the inner city and be in a community without access to resources. Also, what it means to be in between those people who have and who have not. And when you're in law enforcement, that's really one of the roles that you have. So I'm hoping that people come away with an understanding of how it feels to be in both the shoes of the cops and the shoes of people who are on the other side of the law.
Well, they're an amazing achievement, these two books, and I can't wait to meet you. We've been talking with Trudy Nan Boyce, who is the winner of the Pinkley Prize for debut novel for Out of the Blues. Her second novel, published earlier this year, is Old Bones. You can meet her Friday, September 8th at 6 at the NIMS Fine Arts Center, 4301 St. Charles Avenue at the Academy of the Sacred Heart. This is a ticketed event. Tickets are available at Octavia Books. Trudy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I look forward to being in New Orleans.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. David Capello discusses Ensign's The People's Grocer, John G. Schwegman, New Orleans, and the Making of the Modern Retail World, Thursday, August 31st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Michael H. Rubin signs his new legal thriller, Cashed Out, Thursday, September 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. If you love to read The New Yorker magazine, consider joining The New Yorker Reading Group. It meets every Thursday from 1 to 2:30 at the Rosa Keller branch of the New Orleans Public Library. Today's guests, Louise Penny and Trudy Nan Boyce, received the Diana Pinkley Prizes for Crime Fiction Friday, September 8th at 6 at the NIMS Fine Arts Center, 4301 St. Charles Avenue. This is a ticketed event. Tickets are available at Octavia Books or octaviabooks.com and will be exchanged for a copy of Louise Penny's new book, Glass Houses. Catherine K. Fontenot signs the Louisiana Urban Gardener Saturday, September 9th from 8:30 to noon at the Crescent City Farmers Market, 750 Carondelet at Julia Street. The Hill Memorial Library at LSU has a fascinating exhibit, Paper Tigers and Bibliobeasts, featuring works focusing on the relationship between humans and other animals, as documented in the rare books, photographs, historical documents, and print materials in the LSU Library Special Collections. It's free and open to the public and runs through September 16th. For directions and hours of operation, visit lib.lsu.edu/special. Or call 225-578-6544. And coming up, the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival's annual writing contests are now open. And this year, they've added a new category in flash fiction. Here are the categories and deadlines. Short stories of up to 1,000 words are due November 8th. One-act plays no longer than an hour, November 1st. 2 to 4 poems with a combined length of up to 400 lines, November 15th. And fiction up to 7,000 words is due November 30th. For more information, visit tennesseewilliams.net/contest. The North Shore's Big Fat Book Club is taking on Emma by Jane Austen this fall, starting Monday, September 11th through Monday, October 2nd, meeting from 3:30 to 5 at the home of Susan Blaylock. She facilitates the group in Abita Springs. There is a fee, and for more information, email Abita Blaylock, that's B-L-A-L-O-C-K, at gmail.com. When the Southern Independent Booksellers Association meets here September 12th through 15th, one of the highlights is Read NOLA, which takes place Sunday, September 17th from noon to 6 at the Sheraton, New Orleans. It features authors Christine Baker Klein and Jocelyn Jackson in conversation, along with 17 other authors. Tickets are available at SIBA, S-I-B-A, web.site, S-I-T-E, -ym.com. The Fall 2017 New Orleans Writers Workshop semester begins September 18th. The New Orleans Writers Workshop, a community writing program taught by trained published authors, is offering courses of varied lengths, 9-week, 4-week, 2-day, and 1-day, at locations around the city, including NOCA, Antenna, the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, the New Orleans Museum of Art, and the Rosa Keller Library. All skill levels are welcome. Visit neworleanswriters.com to register. Other notable dates to mark on the calendar, the Louisiana Book Festival, which takes place Saturday, October 28th, on the grounds of the state capitol in Baton Rouge. Check out their website for information about the workshops taught by visiting writers Friday, October 27th. And the New Orleans Book Festival will take place Saturday, November 11th in City Park. And on a sad note, we mourn the loss of Diane de las Casas on August 21st. She was an author of many children's books, a great performer and storyteller, and spread the good word about great children's books as the founder of Picture Book Month. Her bright spirit and love of great stories will be sorely missed. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.